The views and opinions expressed by hosts, invited speakers, and callers do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the Black Talk Media Project or the Black Talk Radio Network.
Good evening, everyone. This is Onaje Maweed. You are listening to Race Treaty. It comes to you every Friday night at 9 o'clock. It is my pleasure to be your host tonight. And we have on our airways, no stranger to this station and to the show, Sister Dawoodi Desaire. Sister Dawoodi, how are you doing tonight, my dear sister?
I'm okay. I'm doing well. Very happy to be with you again, my brother, and to be back on this excellent program.
And it's so good to have you on this side of the pond, as they say. we know that you made a trip over to that cold place called Europe. And we're looking forward to some warm conversation to hear about that trip and also an update on the subcommittee to eliminate racism and also the new creations that you are putting in place. So please tell us, where did you go when you went to Europe and why did you go?
Okay. Well, my main purpose in going to Europe was to participate in a conference that I was one of the sponsors of that took place in Rotterdam in the Netherlands. I am, among other things, a member of the Global Coalition for the International Decade for People of African Descent. Myself, my sister, Dr. Beryl Beekman, who was the civil society spokesperson at the launch of the decade at the UN. Brother Kali Akuno, who is the co-director of Cooperation Jackson and a member of the Malcolm X grassroots movement. Jan Lun, who is a cousin from Sweden, who is the secretary of the World Against Racism Network. Brother Amaju Baraka, who is an associate fellow of the Institute of Foreign Affairs, who I believe was one of the first EDs of the USA Network for Human Rights. We are members of the steering committee of this global coalition for the implementation of the International Decade for People of African Descent. And came together to organize an international roundtable that was revisiting Durban Plus 15. We were trying to bring together a worldwide network of Pan-African and anti-racism activists, and specifically to bring people together who had been part of the Durban process, which really stems from 1999 to 2016. We wanted to review what the outcome of Durban, the Durban process has been, and where do we have to go? What challenges do we face? Where do we have to go in the course of the International Decade for People of African Descent, which again is from 2015 to 2024. And so some of the people that we brought together were Dr. Mireille Fanon Mendes-France, who is the chairperson of the Working Group of Experts for People of African Descent, Dr. Lynn Hillgrove, or actually I should call her Makeda, to Makeda now, who is the president of the Mouvement International pour la Réparation, or the International Movement for Reparations, otherwise known as MIR, in Guadeloupe. We had Dr. Dudu Bien, who is the former UN Special Rapporteur against Racism, Discrimination, Xenophobia, Brother Baba Onami Olubanjo Buntu, who is a youth leader, an activist in South Africa, and then lastly, a member of Panaco, Sister Esther Stanford Soshi, who is in the United Kingdom and is a phenomenal speaker on issues specifically related to gender and reparations. So all of us came together during those couple of days to see, all right, where have we been? Where are we going next? And what do we want to see happen in the next in the next 9 years of the decade? Hello? Brother Onaji, I can't hear you. Hello? I don't know if I should just continue speaking because you're having a technical issue on your end. Just so that we don't have empty airtime. So, you know, just interrupt me at at any point, because as I said, I can't hear anything. One of the big things that we talked about during this conference is Afrophobia. And again, Afrophobia is a term that speaks to the specific manifestation of racism and how deeply rooted and accelerated it is against people of African descent. Afrophobia is, we want to make a distinction between that and racism as we understand it, because it is about the kind of fear and irrationality that is presented, a hatred and a violence as manifest against our people, something that we've seen only all too well in a number of ways in terms of structural racism, but also on the streets of our cities where so many African descendants are killed, disarmed people, especially by the police and other agents of the state. Some people refer to this as anti-Black racism, but we're using the language of Afrophobia to speak specifically to that point. And so we want everyone, we're encouraging everyone, because it is part of the legal language of this Durban process and the international human rights community to use that term and to use it extensively, because it really is intended to show the level of abuse and dehumanization as we as African people serve, and to make especially those who are the upholders of white supremacy to understand the degrading nature of their behavior and how dangerous it is to us. So we talked a lot about, again, the use of language that in fact isn't intended to empower us and to make people self-conscious of what they're doing. Brother, can you hear me? If you do, can you send me a text or an email?
Yes, I hear you, Brother Najee. Okay. Are you there, Brother Najee? Okay. It appears he may have gotten dropped again, Sister Dewote. So if you don't mind, okay. I'll go ahead and get him back on.
Okay.
Apologies, listeners, for these technical issues. Please bear with us as we try to connect back with Brother Najee. Brother Najee, you there?
Yes.
Okay. We have him back, Sister Dewote. She was just got through describing a portion of her trip to us and what was discussed.
Yeah.
Excellent.
I couldn't hear you at all. I couldn't hear you at all. So the last thing I talked about was the importance of using the word. And for all of us, be consistent about the use of the word Afrophobia, because in fact, white Europeans, their governments, white European governments seem to think it's a dangerous thing to say. Well, nobody thought it was dangerous to use the word anti-Semitism. So we do need to highlight the specific kind of dehumanization that African people experience, and you know, the word racism is just not it doesn't have the weight that it did anymore, and it doesn't disturb anyone to be called a racist, you know, and that is embodied in the kind of behavior that we see in a couple of politicians who will go unnamed in the Republican Party, who are running for president in this country, and then the massive support that he receives from people here. Another thing that we did talk a lot about was the need to make sure that we work with our youth and with our children in the global community, that they have to be taught awareness of Afrophobia, and we need to instill very practical skills in them to deal and combat with a racist experience, and make sure that they understand that they have an inalienable right to self-determination and emancipation.
This is such a major development to have this clarity. This is really, really important. So at the meeting, you know, I missed some of that. Were there any resolutions or particular programs of actions that came from the meeting?
Well, there were a number of things that were talked about, in addition to, again, achieving consensus amongst us to use this term Afrophobia. We also surprisingly talked a lot about spirituality. I it wasn't surprising in the sense that I was specifically invited to talk about African-based spiritual practices, their relationship to memorials and memory and reparations. But what I did find amazing was that so many times people kept coming back to talking about African-based spirituality. So many people kept talking about how they felt that there was an issue, an internal issue, a spiritual crisis that they were facing with regard to being a Christian or Muslim, that somehow these were not enough for them, that there was something else that was still missing there. And so there was a desire to really talk about African spirituality, the Afro-Atlantic traditions, in a way that, you know, might is somewhat surprising on one hand in within the context of a political conference, but we have to understand that culture and spirituality is about politics. It's about politics because it's about power, and one of the things that I emphasize is, so long as we as African descendants remain afraid of, disrespectful of, vilifying, and stigmatizing religions or spiritual practices like voodoo, candomblé, umbanda, Shango Baptist, and even the AME Church, because all of these religions and Rastafarianism, even though it's Christian, they all came out of a place of resistance among African descendants. But particularly those like voodoo and candomblé and Ubanda, Bwiti, Winti, all of those are very African traditions that are not influenced in quite the same way by Christianity, in particular as the AME Church or Rastafarianism would be. But as long as we hate ourselves and are afraid of ourselves, well, guess what? We leave the door open for others to continue to hate and oppress us. So this issue kept coming up at various times throughout the discussion. And along with that is, how do we begin the process of repairing ourselves? You know, reparations has to start with us, within us, because once we're clear about who we are, what our history is, what and we're spiritually fortified and intellectually strong, well, you know, everything else is not that it's a piece of cake. But it's that much less of a challenge to pursue and obtain reparations. Now, the issue of reparations itself, in terms of instructions or mandate or a kind of program of action, we realized, I mean, I've known this because I've been traveling for many years and working with a variety of African descendant groups, but a lot of other people who are not as fortunate didn't realize just how complex the issue of reparations is, because it becomes a different issue. It has a different face, a different manifestation in every country that African descendants are found. So what we're looking for here in the United States, in terms of reparations, may not be what is needed in Haiti, and is definitely not what Afro-Surinamese need in the Netherlands, and may not be what Africans in France or in Spain are looking for. So, you know, it was recommended that, because we only have 9 years left to this decade, that first of all, we got to identify who is an Afro-descendant. Right? How are we defining an African descendant? And that could be an individual thing, but it could be a national thing. So, who is an African descendant? Then, what does reparation look like for each of us, where we come from? And then, what plan of action do we need to put in place, you know, based on what is it that we seek to actually secure reparations? So that's a big and complicated exercise, because we'll see, as I said, you know, in, say in the case of IT, there is a legal and historical precedent for demanding reparations. We have a paper trail going back to the 19th century for why we should be getting reparations. African Americans in the United States might not be able to do that, but you all have treaties. There were you know, the 40 acres and a mule that was promised to emancipated Africans, and that was never realized. In other parts of the world, in Europe, there are rules that don't even allow African descendants to laws that don't even allow African descendants to identify themselves, so that you don't even know how many people of African descent you have in your country. So you know, part of the work is quantifying and qualifying how many people there are in each place that looks for reparations, who are African descendants, and then what the face of reparations will be like. We did determine that we do, again, have to qualify and quantify everything. So we need numbers that make sense. How big our populations are, where are we based, what acts of discrimination are committed against us. A census has to be taken in some places so we can determine whether or not there's adequate housing and social services and education, and all of the basic needs that we have as human beings. Are our states providing that to us? And to that end, while we know there's a bunch of states, nation states like the United States, Canada, France, Israel, a few other places that did not ratify the Durban Declaration and Program of Action Plan, we also know that the General Assembly Program of Action for the decade, all right, the decade of international descent, everybody voted in favor of that. Everybody said that yes, we have to close the equality gaps in education and housing, healthcare, et cetera, that exist, those disparities amongst African descendants. Everybody said we have to find a way to end racism, racial discrimination, xenophobia, and the intersectional spaces of Afrophobia and racism. All the nation states voted in favor of that. So if your country, no matter where you're from, voted in favor of that, then guess what? It's up to us as civil society to make sure that, in fact, your government is upholding what they, you know, voted to do at the United Nations. So each of us as members of civil society, no matter where we're based, are going to have to write our elected officials, are going to have to reach out to our diplomatic community and say, yo, what's up? You know, you voted for this. So what are you doing to help us realize these goals? You know, what resources are you do you have in place? What budget is there? What facilities do we have to help realize some of these objectives? So we have to hold our government accountable. Those are some of the charges that were made that we have to walk away pushing to be realized.
So how many participants did you have with from the different parts of the world?
I would say it wasn't a big conference, but I would say there were about 60 to 75 people there. There was a very large group of people who came from the Nation of Islam, came from the United Kingdom, from England specifically. There were a number of South Africans. There was a large group of young Belgians of African descent, professionals, young professionals who were there, and there were white allies there as well. And again, it was a round table, so it wasn't as formally structured as other things are, but there was a lot to be said, a lot to be unpacked. One of the things that I realized is how angry and hurt a lot of folks are. And there are expectations that we have of the UN, of the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights. The High Commissioner's Office, for instance, is supposed to be managing the decade, but they're not doing what they're supposed to do. There's a budget of $1 million a year for each year of the decade, and that money is being squandered or is being allocated towards other resources. The staffing that's supposed to be in place to help implement the activities of the decade is not there. There's no accountability for where the money is or what they're doing with it. And it's going to continue that way until unless, we as civil society, including NGOs, we stay on top of them, we're not going to get the results that that we're looking for. And the decade will end up being a failure that way. And we can't afford to have that happen.
So how can we hold them accountable? Who should we hold accountable?
Well, we need to hold the Working Group of Experts for People of African Descent accountable. They're supposed to be on our side, speaking on our behalf. We have to make sure that they are following up on the things that we said we needed. As you know, they were here not too long ago, did a country report, and the most important thing that they said was how this country has done a huge disservice to African descendants by refusing to talk about the issue of reparations and not having a truth and reconciliation commission to deal with the extrajudicial killings, to deal with all of the disparities, the prison industrial complex, all of the things that make life terrible for people of African descent here. So they've been good about writing out their reports. But then there's other stuff, administrative, internal things, keeping an eye on the budget, advocating and fighting on our behalf. Things that happen behind closed doors that we're not necessarily privy to, they need to know that we're watching them and that there are expectations that they will follow up and meet on our behalf. We need to stay on top of the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights to make sure that he takes the money and the resources that are allocated towards the decade to in fact help people of African descent, and that money isn't being siphoned off or deflected towards, counterterrorism and security. Because we are under a constant state of terrorism. We are being terrorized on a daily basis through structural racism and white supremacy. So those funds are needed here, and they need to understand that that is just as important, if not more important at this point, than anything else that's going on the planet. Because it's, when you stop and think about it, I mean, I think we all know that when you look at the culmination of horrors that are born of structural racism, it's an act of cultural genocide and physical genocide that's being committed against people of African descent globally. So those people have to be held accountable, as well as I said, as our governments, because our consulates, our missions, your parliaments, if you live in that kind of a system, not living in the U.S., these countries, our governments, elected and voted in favor, hands down, to implement the activities of the decade. It's a 12-page document that I encourage everybody to look at. Go online on the UN website. You know, it's worldwideweb.un.org, and look for the GA resolution, the Program of Action for the Decade, which was issued in December of 2015. So you'll see what it is, and that way you know what to demand.
So, listening audience, we're going to take a break. Please stay tuned when we come back to Race Treaty Radio to listen more from our guest, Sister Dawoodi Desir. So everyone, see you in a few moments.
This is Brother Elliot, host of Time for an Awakening, and you're listening to Black Talk Radio Network, new media for the new millennium.
Welcome back. This is Onaje Mawid, and with us tonight is Sister Dawoodi Desir, who has shared with us her trip to Netherlands and the purpose of this convergence of Pan-Africanists from around the world, and how they spoke about the need to hold these governments accountable who signed on to the United Nations Treaty Against Racism, and also how they supported the Program of Action. So, Sister Dawoodi, as you know, citizens in these various nation states or whatever the case may be, should we be writing our government officials? Should we be writing straight to the United Nations? Who needs to be communicated to? I think you mentioned the High Commissioner on Human Rights.
Yes, the High Commissioner for Human Rights is a UN affiliate, and they're the ones who are actually managing the decade. We have to write our governments. Every government was we should ask each government, wherever we're from, to issue a letter of commitment to supporting the international decade and to implement the programs and activities that are related to it. We said that each and every government should engage the forces of civil society and social movements that represent people of African descent to be democratic in their approach, and make sure that we are included in shaping how the particular programs and activities for our respective countries should look like. That each budget has to create a budget, each government has to create a budget to support on a national, regional, and international level the program of activities that they said that they would support. So if it's health, for instance, having potable water is a huge issue. So let's make sure people have potable water locally. Let's make sure that there are roads there on a national basis that help people get to hospitals if it's needed. Let's make sure that if there are certain medications, be they homeopathic, organic medicines, or other kinds of medicines that are needed to help sustain health or build a cohesive health network in a region that's there. If there are issues of pollution then that are impacting people's health, then how do we work within our regions to remedy that so it doesn't have an adverse effect on people's health? And then, you know, and then looking at health issues internationally. I'm just using that as an example, but it could be anything. Our countries have to do that. And we also suggested that each government make a public commitment to mobilize their allies to support and promote the international decade. You know, and be held accountable. But if our governments think, well, ain't nobody paying attention, nobody knows, they don't provide people with resources to do things, space, money, opportunity, then that becomes that much more difficult to meet those objectives. I mean, we, no matter where we are, civil society have to fight. In fact, let me backtrack for a second. The first thing that came out of my mouth and that came out of the mouths of some of the other people who were on the panel was making it clear to everyone present that we are in a war. We are in a war. And the war is being led against Afro-descendants. And when you understand that you are in a war, there's no time to rest. There's no time to say, oh, I'm going to put this off until tomorrow. We're under siege. And so when you understand that you're under siege, you assume a very different mindset and understand that by any means necessary, you got to fight, you got to work to stay alive. You got to keep yourself healthy so you can keep fighting the fight. You got to teach your children so that the fight, if it doesn't end in our lifetime, it's going to continue in theirs, but hopefully it will continue in their. They'll have the resources, the knowledge, the skills that they need to fight and win. Our governments consist of other people who live in our communities with us. They're not some abstract entity who are disaffected by what happens in the rest of society. So make them accountable, write them, email them, knock on their door if you know where they live. But make sure that they know that you know that there is a set of expectations that they are expected to realize on our behalf. Most of the time, our governments are there because we put them in place, you know. And it's the same way. Nobody wants to be taxed without representation. You don't want to put your government in place, a government in place that's supposed to support you and realize certain objectives for its citizenry on a certain level, and they're not doing their work. Why are they there at all?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, by chance, was there a document that came out of the conference that we started to circulate to our communities?
There is an outcome document that is being developed. Every speaker has to contribute like a summary of what they've done. So there are a number of speakers, and so we're waiting for their remarks. I myself have been editing some of the text that doesn't require anybody else's voice, but is the summary of all that was said. And when you're working with people, you're not always going to agree on how things are said or the way that they're said, and so there's. There are things that need to be refined, and of course, not everybody speaks. We don't all speak the same language. were coming, I mean, literally, English is not necessarily the first language of a number of the participants and the organizers. So there are linguistic things that have to be looked at. But also there are things that I think need to be spelled out further, especially with regards to race, reparations, and how that might look in various places. So the document is being refined. I think it's going to take a month before it's fully organized, and when it's completed, we will post it on our website, which is durbanplus15.org, and then we will share it with you, Brother Anaje, and Brother Scotty, so that everyone sees what we concluded.
Excellent.
Continue the dialogue.
We look forward to receiving it when it's finished. And on the state side, in terms of your work as its Madam Chair of the Subcommittee to Eliminate Racism, I understand that you have put forth a proposal to actually come out of the Human Rights Committee and form a committee on its own standing. Is that not so?
Yes, it is. The Subcommittee for the Elimination of Racism, of the NGO Committee for Human Rights, will be, like Prince, formerly known as. And we are renaming ourselves the Committee for the Elimination of Racism, Afrophobia, and Colorism, otherwise known as CRAC. And we are we're going to continue doing some of the work that we did in the past in terms of advocating at the UN on behalf of victims of racism, Afrophobia, and colorism. We're going to do that educational work. There's a lot of people who don't know what colorism is. A lot of people who feel like, oh, we don't have to talk about Afrophobia per se because racism includes Afrophobia. So we have to make it clear why these things are an issue and how they're all manifestations of white supremacy that continues to hold everybody back, including white people themselves. And we are trying to get ourselves in a place where we are not under the threat of being dissolved by the committee that oversees us. So we have we've been collecting letters of support from organizations that, in fact, want to be founding members of our new committee. We need 20 documents with, a very particular kind of status at the UN and have to have a particular kind of membership. And at the end of this month, I think we may have either 19 or possibly by now, actually 20 of the 20 that we need, the signatures that we need. And so at the end of this month, we'll present it to the conference of NGOs to see if they will approve us as a standalone committee. And we have decided that whether or not they do so, more importantly, whether or not we have the 20 signatures that we need, we're going to continue to operate as a committee until we get all the signatures that we need. We need to acquire a certain status at the UN so that we can have access to space and other resources to do the work that we do there. But having said that, with becoming a standalone committee, we can take a bigger role, a more prominent role in helping to determine a course of action for civil society with regard to the international decade. One of the things that we'll be doing, I believe, is the May 20th through the 22nd, is we'll be at the Left Forum at John Jay School of Criminal Justice. We're going to be organizing a panel on reparations there. We're going to be organizing a couple of film screenings and other events that are going to help use the tool of culture to educate people further about the nature of racism and Afrophobia and how we can work towards its elimination.
If someone wanted to get in touch with you, Sister Dunwoody, how would they do that?
You can write me at Dorothy Dizia at gmail.com. So it's Dowotidesir as one word at gmail.com. I think we also have
say that one more time for me.
Dowotidesir as one word at gmail.com. And I believe we also have an email address, which is NGO CARK, CARK at gmail.com.
Excellent.
Sorry, did I say
so?
No, let me take that back. I said NGOCERC at gmail.com. CRAC with a C at the end, not with a K.
with a C. Okay. So we want to thank you, Sister Dunwoody, for all that you have invested in this process, because we know that no one was paying for your ticket to the Netherlands. And the hotel
exactly.
And everything else. So you have you have invested in us, and I want to acknowledge that, and want to thank you for that, and say that we appreciate you all that you do for us, and certainly we'll have you back as soon as all the things line up for that to happen. But we'd like to thank you at this time and sign off. This is Onaji Wade for Race Treaty, and like I say, good night.
Good night. Thank you both. Peace.
Thank you. Peace.
Whoa. Oh, mercy me. Oh, things ain't what they used to be now. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the rain that blows from the north and south.